The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Gareth, how are you, brother?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
Yes, good, mate. Always good to chat to a fellow Royal Marines Commando. And I'm saying that especially because apparently YouTube recognises the first words in your in a video, and that's what it goes on to promote it.
Really? Wow. Wow.
Some of my videos, I think, don't get many views because I normally just start by, all right, mate, yeah. And then we chat about the weather, and then we chat about whatever nonsense is going on, and then we get on to the subject. But Gareth, absolutely massive congratulations on your book, Becoming the 0.1%. Here we go, folks. There'll be a link below. I suggest everyone reads it, military, non-military, whatever, because it's just a cracking book. It covers a time that many of us boys had at a place called Lympston Commando, the Commando Training Center, Royal Marines. And it's a great read for anyone, but for those of us that went through it, will certainly bring back a few memories. 34 lessons from the diary of a Royal Marines Commando recruit. They said Royal Marines again there, so this video's going to hit, mate.
We're having it.
How to Build an Elite Mindset by Gareth Timmins, RM, which stands for Royal Marines, by the way, if I didn't mention it. Mate, what I loved, the first thing that I hadn't really thought of before, people often say, you know, how tough is it to get a green berry or whatever? And I always try to give an approximation of how many people go in the recruiting office and try, and some people will fail there and then. The recruiting sergeant will look at them and go, we're not having this one. not in a nasty way, but, you know, it's not for everybody. We had a recruit, Hansen, in our troop, Gareth, and, I shouldn't probably have said his name. I hope he doesn't mind, but we all fell in on the parade square about week 3, I think. The drill sergeant called us up to attention. Hansen, prove. Right, double away to the training team's office. And off he went. And the drill corporal just turned to us and went, take one last look at Hansen, men. Hansen is a teddy bear. And there's no room in the Royal Marines for teddy bears. By teddy bear, folks, I don't mean gay. I mean he was just a very soft and gentle a soft and gentle lad. He was absolutely lovely. Everyone thought the world of him. He used to sing us off to sleep at night when he was doing his ironing. But as I say, it's not for everyone.
No.
And so I've always tried to give an approximation of how many people go to a recruiting office and how many actually get their green lid. But you've captured it up very well with 1 in 1,000. So that not just the 1% that the recruiting adverts say, but 0.1%, of which you are one.
And yourself.
Yes. How's the book been received?
Really well, mate. It's been it's just blown me away. It's been absolutely incredible. There was a lot of energy prior to publication, and it's taken quite a while. It took months to go through the MOD, which we were all quite kind of nervous about, but I mean, how it's been received, mate, it's just been unbelievable. The feedback, the energy, it's been bestseller on Amazon. It's just been fantastic, mate. Really, really, really just delighted.
Yeah, what is it about the Marines that produces so many best-selling authors?
I think the way that they've created, it's a brand, isn't it? I think the way they've created the Royal Marines brand and the amazing adverts that they've had over the years, and obviously the length and how difficult it is once people become aware of it, it just creates so much mystery and intrigue, and people just want to know, don't they? Whether you're interested or not in the military, people just are fascinated by it.
So the other side of the coin, though, you know, writing a book is not, it's no mean feat. It's utter dedication, talking anything up to 18-hour days for anything up to two years. And also you've got to have kind of the literary stuff to make it happen. And I think that says a lot about the quality of the men that find themselves in the Marines.
Absolutely. I mean, the diversity in the Marines and what you get is quite unbelievable, isn't it? You can have, like, there's people in the Marines that are artists, that are ex-sports people, that have done all weird and wonderful things and go on to do all weird and wonderful things after. And you just end up with a network of people that are often quite exceptional in all different kind of fields of whatever they go into. But it definitely attracts a special type of person. I think entrepreneurial would be a great kind of summarization of the people that make it to the end and some that obviously drop out as well. But it definitely attracts people that are that accept risk and that are willing to take risk on, and then that transfers into all kinds of successes when they leave.
It's a funny thing in the publishing industry as well, because I don't think they caught up really with modern methods. I think they're still living in the past a lot. And this thing about bringing a book out in hardback that they still stick to this day. It used to be a thing that it used to work because there weren't so many authors out there. There weren't so many authors that could just self-publish on Amazon or whatever it is. They had a very select few. They kind of, you know, these publishers ruled the roost, so they could afford to say, hey, the special paperback is out now. And if it was a Wilbur Smith or whatever, you know, there's a million people immediately just will buy it. But
yeah,
this day and age with so much competition, when you want your book to smack into the market and make an effect and get people talking, you know, five people talking to five people to five people saying, read this book, that's the kind of marketing wave that you want to create. But they still stick with this thing, because I bet you've had people already go, oh, well, I'll wait for the paperback.
Yeah, there's been a few people that are quite remarkable, they do prefer the paperback. I think in recent times with technology, people are more wanting to download books and also listen to the audio. There's so many people that say to me, look, I don't enjoy reading, but I'll get it on audio. So times are changing with it. They really are. And it is quite interesting. Touching on your approach as well in terms of marketing, word of mouth is just so powerful. And that's what I've found over this last 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks, is just that just somebody as simple as putting it on Facebook and saying, great book. You see the comments underneath and people like, just ordered. Really, is it a great book? And it's just so powerful, that kind of personal validation or that personal relationship that somebody else has got with somebody else, that like trust that they've got between themselves. As soon as that goes up, you get some good success from that.
Mm. I'm guessing also there's probably quite a few disillusioned young men out there. By that, I mean, you know, an office job, it's just not. And not, you know, we don't have a lot of industry anymore. We don't sort of build ships and melt iron and dig coal. So it's kind of funneled everyone into office jobs, isn't it? Sat behind a computer for 8 hours a day, possibly for a boss that you don't really like.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people like to live vicariously now through the armed forces. You know, if I can't join, I want to read about it. Or maybe they're reading about it because they're thinking, maybe I need a change of career.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody, no matter who you are, you always want to be better. You always want to learn how to get better mentally and physically. And I think books like this and other books that are in its kind of field definitely kind of fit that void. I think COVID as well. COVID's played a massive factor in, I think, the probably desirability of this book as well in terms of helping people get back on track, get back into a good mindset. And I think the lessons that I've kind of put in it are just, it's psychology that hopefully everybody can understand. It's like the kind of layperson's understanding of psychology. It's understandings about ourselves that we all know about our own minds, but we don't, it's not reinforced academically. And that's kind of what I kind of wanted to achieve. But yeah, it's just, I think everybody wants a tool, or everybody's always looking for a drink or something to make them feel better, something to make them perform better. Everybody's, we all want it, no matter who we are.
Yes. And so you're getting on the train to go off to Lymston, and your mum rushes in a bookshop, comes out with a diary, and goes, "There you go, son, write it all down." This is not an approach I've heard of before.
No, absolutely not. It was the most bizarre gift that anybody could have given me. I'm sure I will, like yourself, Chris, when we were younger, we all kind of fit the same mold. There was young bootnecks, but I wasn't academic as a young lad. I didn't read. I didn't want to read. I wasn't very good at reading. And when I left, of all things, on the train, just as the train doors were shutting at Wakefield Westgate, my mum gave me, literally put this diary in my hand as the door shut. And through the window, she's just saying, "Just write it down, it'll help. Just write things down. I want to see what's going on." And train took off, and I was just, it's like, what on earth? Like, crazy mindset. And as I'm kind of going down on the train to Lymston, you know what it's like, mate. You're nervous. You don't know what you're doing. You're in a sense of disbelief. And I thought, I'm just going to open it and just write how I'm feeling and see if it settles me, see if I feel better. And I did, and I just kind of documented that I felt nervous but excited, and that I felt like we're on a roller coaster. And I was strapped in on my way, but all of a sudden you want to get off and you want to stop it, but you can't. And I wrote it in, and kind of from that moment on, I just felt completely compelled to keep it. And that's what I did.
It's interesting, mate, reading it as well, because whereas Lymston's pretty much the same for everybody, isn't it? It's like a blueprint, or maybe there's a more appropriate analogy. But this is obviously getting into your mindset of how you felt as you went through. So immediately I see when you're in the, it's called foundation when you went through, that it's called induction when I went through. They have to change that because induction just sounds like brainwashing.
Which it was.
Yeah. Brainwashing into how to iron properly.
Yeah, and shower.
Yes, and polish lots of stuff. But I noticed, as you said, you were down, you felt quite down quite a lot. Whereas my experience was I didn't even have I don't think I had time to, I wouldn't have known how to feel down at 18 years old. Mm. To me, every day was certainly in training, every day was just get on and just get through it. And you do allude to that. I notice as you go through, but I was kind of just bright eyed, you know, wide eyed, really. Right. What I was very naive as well.
Mm.
But I had the fortunate thing in my corner was I was a bit. Have you ever seen Officer and a Gentleman with Richard Gere?
I have. Yeah.
And where he's beasting him and he's trying to get him to, was it DOR, drop on request, I think they call it.
Yeah.
And he's like, "I want you out of here, mayonnaise." And he's like, "But I got nowhere else to go." Well, that was me, because I was living in my car. I was basically homeless and living in a Renault 12 when I joined up. So I had nothing else. So I didn't have that psychological, "Oh, I could go home to a nice family." Oh. And,
yeah, yeah.
Do you think that might be a more of a modern thing, though? Because people, young men now, seem to be more sensitive.
It's a great point, Chris. I think that when we went through in 2005, mobile phones had not long been out. And you certainly couldn't get onto the internet like you could now. Google was, and certainly getting onto the internet with efficiency and access was tough, if not impossible. There were still black and white phones with Snake. But you were still more connected than what you would have been. And I think that being connected to society and your support system potentially makes you a bit of a weaker asset. And I think more so now with how good connectivity is. I mean, you're always connected, aren't you? And I think, alluding back to your point, I think living in your car, I think that's such a strong place to be mentally when you've got nothing in a sense to lose. You've got no pulls. I just found that when I were in training, I had no girlfriend, and that was for me the best place to be. There were so many good lads that you would have tipped at the start to get to the end that left for girls or left for other kind of family issues, whether genuine or not. But yeah, I think it's a great point. I think the reason why they brought the ROP in was because there were so many young lads getting stress fractures, and that's because the skeletal composition is just not tough enough in the lower legs now to withstand the impact from training. They're getting stress fractures. So they brought the ROP in to kind of build them up to stop the immense dropout rate. And that's all because kids are no longer jumping out of trees, young lads. They're not playing tigs in the street and hide and seek and stuff. It's more a sedentary lifestyle. And that's, I think that's quite profound, really.
Yeah, they're not nicking enough stuff. Get out and do some proper shoplifting like the good old days.
Yeah, they're not pinching bottles of milk off people's doorsteps and stuff.
Yes. Yes, so ROP, is this pre-month now that we hear about?
Yeah, it is. I think it's, from what I've heard, it's still tough. I don't think they're ever going to change the fabric of training, or I hope they wouldn't, but it's tough, and there's a hell of a lot of people that drop out in ROP as well. It essentially makes training 36 weeks. Mm. But I have heard literally in a number of days that they're going to go back to the PRMC. I think the cost of it, I heard that the cost of the PRMC wasn't cost effective, but I just think it's a fantastic part of the process, me, is the PRMC.
Yes, that was called the PRC back in my day. So for friends at home, the ROP is, what does that acronym stand for?
Recruit Orientation Phase.
Yeah. So this is the bit where apparently lads rocking up at Limpson just don't know what's hit them and don't really have the minerals for entering what is essentially the toughest military basic training, infantry training in the world.
In the world.
Not to yeah. Special forces if I'm talking about like basic infantry level. And then the PRC was Potential Recruits Course, now called PRMC, Potential Royal Marines Course. I mean, my God, that was tough enough in itself. And to think that during this recent stuff that's been going on, that's been done online. And I mean, you can't swap. Bloody hell, first moment there on our three-day PRC was throwing ourselves backwards off the high diving board. Right? like what you see Ant Middleton getting the candidates to do on SAS, yeah. We had to do that, just stand there, fall backwards. And if you hesitated, that was it. They'd say, right, go and get the train.
Yeah.
Then that's followed by an hour swim, just swimming, endless, blooming, swimming around the pool, swimming across the pool, then hit the gymnasium. And I was watching a Dirty Sanchez video the other day when the boys rocked up at Linston and they got beasted and they were all throwing up.
That's superb, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So funny.
But would you agree, when you're in training, you don't throw up. You grow with the program. It's the PRMC that it shut such a shock to the system that lads were spewing up and just going home. We had lads falling off the ropes on their head and they were getting sent home.
Yeah, yeah. There's lads as well. There's lads that pass the PRMC that never go back. there's lads also that pass the PRMC that go down on the train, and then when they stop outside a camp to start training, they stay on it and go home.
Yeah, when we...
That's how intimidating that place is.
When we got in the induction block, there was three empty beds. Three guys hadn't got... They stayed on the train. And wonder what they're doing now.
Yeah, yeah. It's just an unbelievable place, isn't it? And like, just touching on PRMC again, it's like, on our first day, I mean, the first night, although felt quite hostile, the next day is when your gym tests start, and we start with a 3 mile run, and the PTI came in, just kicked the door open at 5 in the morning, followed by another load of PTIs, and one of them kicked a locker and a load of boots fell out, and we're frantically racing to put these boots on, and I had a size 8 on one foot and a 10 on the other, and it was just absolute carnage, and then you get beasted. It was just an unbelievable experience.
Yes. And how did you make time for the diary? I say this with interest because I was, this is just going to sound really stupid, but I missed somewhere in the program, I missed a crucial bit of information. And that is that you only wash your shirt like every day in your smalls. You don't have to wash your denims and this. So there were lads, maybe they'd wear their stone shirt on parade for what 2 hours or something. They were just hanging it back up. And there's me, Mr. fucking stupid, washing literally everything I wore every single time I wore it. And I did that all the way through training. I missed the memo that said you haven't got to do that, right? So I was up till 12, 1 o'clock every single night, even up until King Squad. I couldn't work out why there were lads like, on their bed reading a book or going ashore. I certainly didn't have time for the diary, but you clearly made time for it.
Yeah, I've always had like really bad OCD, and I've had it from birth, and I think this is probably something to do with it. I played rugby before I went in, and I always kind of played. I wanted to master the game with the perfection and also the perfection side of OCD. And once I'd started that kind of process on the train, it were almost like I had to continue. And it were almost like an anchor of stability and an extrinsic motivational factor for me to stay in and complete it. Because you imagine coming out of training after 4 or 6 weeks or midway through with half a diary. That is it's an awful reminder of failure, is that. So it almost kept me in. And it was really tough. Sometimes we'd been to sleep for days and writing it was horrific, especially when lads were getting in bed. And sometimes you've only got an hour and a half, 2 hours before you're up again anyway. But it were tough at times. It were really tough. I mean, when I went in the field, sometimes I had to write on my arms and on my hands and just little buzzwords that I could then remember that for when I got out and then just kind of document it again. But yeah, well, it were a tough one.
Yeah. Gareth, were you worried at all that the training team, did they know you were writing it?
On my 21st birthday, which came shortly after me joining, about week 8 or something like that, I put my cards around my bed and the training team came up and they were like, no effing cards around here, and ripped them all up. And literally just ripped them all up and just dropped them in front of me by my feet. And I'm like, oh, bloody hell. That made me really, really anxious then about them finding the diary. Because I thought if they find this, they're 100% going to rip it up. And at that point, I'd captured some really, really rich, unbelievable stuff in there. And then all of a sudden, one of the days, they just walked round unannounced. And I was sat on the bed with one lad while I was writing it. And they were like, what's that? And I reluctantly told him, and he looked through it, and as he's looking through it, I think he's going to rack pages out any minute. And he was just like, it's hoofing. And they absolutely supported me in continuing it on. And from that moment on, I were able to kind of waterproof it and take it in the field. Don't get me wrong, they never give me the opportunity to write in it. That were up to me to kind of find the time. But they kind of got behind it, and that really helped with completing it.
Did you write, like, our section corporal is incredibly handsome? He's like the big brother I never had.
I absolutely did, Jeff, for next time he came round.
Yes. Let's talk about my old nemesis. We touched on it but before we recorded the endurance course, because that, for me, I don't know, I think that epitomised my experience of commander. It was the moment when I understood the difference, you know, what separates the men from the boys. And I guess it's because it's the first time in training, pretty much, that you have to do something on your own, certainly something that's so epic. And yeah. By that, I mean it's only you and your thoughts that are going to get you through that course. And everyone's pretty, I wouldn't say physically on a par, because we had some, like, we had Welsh rugby players and they were just freaking hoofing at the fizz, you know?
Yeah.
But you all know you can pass it. It's just whether you can turn that switch in your head. And that I only passed it on the day, so I think I failed 2 run-throughs. And on that day, I remember thinking, right, do I want this bad enough? Yes. Fucking start running then.
Yeah.
And I started, yeah. And I didn't stop.
Yeah, it's, I call it in the book, like, the day training is like the daily burden of failure. It's like a massive coat that you wear every day, and it's oppressive and it weighs you down. And absolutely, mate, the endurance for me was my nemesis. And I've put the word nemesis in there as well, which is quite unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, I failed every run through, partly because my conduct on leave was just atrocious, but I failed every run through. And when it got to the day, there's so many things that can go wrong. The worst thing about it, mate, is that you're under time, isn't it? As soon as you start, the time's on, and you have, in a sense, you haven't got a lot of it. And at any point that you misjudge something, you could say more so on the TAS and the slot course, but on the endurance as well, you could wrong foot in, you could get caught on the sheep depot or whatever, and you're really up against it, and you could fail, and then you've got to get back, and you're flapping about the chute whether your weapon's going to work. And it's just, your anxiety's through the roof, isn't it? It's just, and you just, no matter how mentally tough that you get, and you do get mentally tough throughout training, you never know that you're going to do it until you've literally crossed the bridge on the 30 miler, do you? It's just, it's one of them, however they've engineered it or whoever's done it, it's just incredible, because nobody can profess at any stage that they think that they've got it until you've literally got that green lid on your head at the end.
Yeah, I can't remember if I did the battle swimming test before or after the 30 miler. I was one of the last people to pass it. And they generally do that rerun in the King Squad fortnight or week. I can't remember what we had. But yeah, I can't remember that being it. I can't remember getting, like, my commando flashes and going, I do remember feeling, yes, result. We've done it. So I guess I must have done the swim by then, but sometimes they keep it to the, and that, I mean, that, if you're a skinny chap, that's the hardest test.
Not,
I mean, you're not blowing out your, but if you're drowning, that's kind of quite a bad result, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I do know that they often chopped and changed it. I think at one point you did field firing after your commando tests. And that rounded off the end of training. But certainly when I went through, and I think it had only just changed, the end of training was crossing the bridge and getting your green lid and your flashes. Mm. And all I can remember thinking, mate, is I'm just glad it's over. I'm just glad it's over. It wasn't the presentation of the green lid as such, but I was just so thankful that the nightmare was over. And it were a nightmare. It was just a brutal, vivid, an enduring nightmare that felt like it had gone on all your life, never mind 10 months.
Yeah.
But yeah. What an experience.
When I was sat on the four-tonner coming back from the 30-miler, I still had a Snickers bar in my webbing pouch. They called them marathons back then. And it was because I just had no appetite to eat. you know, we were just pushing it so much. I just couldn't face eating a bloody bar of chocolate. I do remember getting on the phone going, "I've done it, Dad." He went, "Oh, yeah, all right, son." Da-da-da-da. You're like, "What?"
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there were a point on it where we'd gone up the hill from Oldcampton Barracks, and it was like a real fast speed march pace up this mile or one and a half mile gradient, and my legs were just like lead, and I just felt like we're not even a mile in and I'm absolutely hanging out here. And then we got to 12 mile checkpoint and not even halfway, and I was absolutely busted up and broken. And like you said, you get into all these checkpoints then, every 6 mile checkpoint, and you're not feeling great, and you can't eat, can you, mate? It's weird. You're so dry mouthed, and you're like, adrenaline's just, you're eating, but you're like having to swill it down with water. It's just an unbelievable test. Is that I underestimated it. I thought I had it in the bag, the 30 miler. Once I'd got there, I thought easy, just head down and just plod on. But oh no, it caught me out.
Yes. And what are you up to now, then, Gareth? Because well, we chatted earlier, and I'm proud to say you're a spiritual guy, which is, I think, is one thing demonstrating you've got an elite mindset, which we've all done. But then is taking it to the next level in life, isn't there? You know, you can go through life resting on your laurels because you got a green lid when you were 18, or in your case, or 19, in your case, 21. But there's a lot more to life, isn't there?
There really is, mate. You know, I started studying psychology when I was 28. Before that, I'd always been really intrigued by it. I've always been like a really, really deep thinker, and always wanted to kind of work things out, especially myself. And this is kind of where it all started. So when I was a young lad, I was just like a burning fire, a ferocious burning fire. I had, in a sense, disregard for many, really, and only regard for few. And I wanted to work out who that boy was, and also why I had such a propensity to want to go and experience war. And in a sense, I had such a lack of empathy at that age. And I thought, oh, look, I'm going to go down a line of inquiry of forensic psychology just to see what it's all about. Why are we so, in a sense, predisposed to want to inflict harm on each other and destroy everything that we've got around us? In a more general kind of sense. Mm. And it just absolutely, I mean, I started it. I didn't think at all I could do it, but I just applied the same kind of mindset that I had done in the Marines, of just getting there, head down, take a few weeks off, and let's see how far we can get. And throughout it, I just became absolutely fascinated into, I suppose, in a sense, our existence and what's the meaning of it and what we're doing, and just really trying to work it out. And I'm still trying. I think I'll always be trying to work it out. I'll never be kind of satisfied of my understanding of things. Mm. The meaning of things. So yeah, I mean, my kind of, I suppose, fascination with humanity really just came from a wanting to understand myself better and why I was a particular person.
Yeah, I guess for, I would say, young people, but probably a lot of people, if not most, they'd be surprised, wouldn't they, to learn that Limpson Commander doesn't make a warrior. It makes people that can go to war, but what makes a warrior is reading books. I think that, would you agree, that would probably surprise most people?
Absolutely. I think there's so much of life that you don't know, and you can quite easily be, I think, in a sense, fall into the illusion of what society has socially created. And it's only like when you start reading books, I think, powerful books that resonate with you, especially the stuff that I read about in psychology, on stuff like bystander effect and on class structure and where it all comes from and just everything, really. It just expands your mind, and you start being critical with what you're seeing around you, and your evaluation is, I think, of those that information's in depth, and it just broadens just broadens your horizons. And I can just remember, even now, like when I put the lessons into the book, the lessons kind of emerged from the weeks, the construct of masculinity, lesson two, looking at recruiting hero and stuff like that. And savannah type environments, looking at our senses are not evolved to live in urban environments yet, even after all these years. It's all stuff that we all should know.
Yeah.
But yet we don't get taught it in school. And I just can't believe it. It's almost like I want to get these six or eight books that I've got from my time at uni and just sit people down and make them ingest it, because it would make the world and society such a better place. It'd help us with our climate response and just everything else like that. Like we touched on before, mate, in terms of eating habits, what we're supposed to be putting into our bodies, just everything. It'd make us such better people if we just had just a tiny bit of academic material inside us.
Yes. Unfortunately, the matrix is controlled, isn't it? My kind of thinking there is sociopaths, psychopaths, mix of the two. But like, if you can't know love, you can't pick up a baby and feel that, oh, you know, that there's, you should be protecting this. And if you're a psychopath or sociopath, you can't have that. You just, by definition, so you're going through the motions, going, hello.
It's true.
If you can never know love of your fellow human beings, then all you've got in your life is control. You know, you're never going to get the satisfaction of being an enlightened individual that can just love all people and your, maybe not your every action, but you try to make your action about being the best you can be for others. But if you don't possess that emotion, because you're not born with it, or you were psychologized as an infant into not, you know, by a bullying corporate trillionaire father that this is the way, and you see this in people like the Bush family and so on and so forth.
Very, very robotic.
This utter disregard and incompassion, utter disregard for human life. Well, then the only way you can get your kicks in life is through control. So it's the complete opposite end of the scale. And it's these controllers that they control everything. Like you say, they control the education system. They control what we understand about diet. I mean, you take psychology. So you've got famous, you know, the famous psychologists there talk about, was it id, ego, superego? They never talk about being caught a set of carbon molecules flying through the atmosphere, do they? You know, they want to keep you in that birth certificate identity, trying to make sense of the world as this individual that's so bloody self but not understanding is such a bigger thing going on here. And then until you can detach from being, you know, Chris or Gareth, you're never going to self-actualize, as in reach the pyramid of what you were put on the planet to be, or what you were put in the universe to be. And I think it's brilliant that two bootnecks can have this conversation.
Absolutely, mate. I think, again, like we spoke before we came on, I mean, if you look at the scientific basis of existence, we're just manifestations of the universe that embody the intelligence and an awareness to reflect back upon ourselves and try and understand the universe, trying to understand itself. It's so quite unbelievable.
And you're you and I'm me. No, you're me and I'm you. It's why I wish you all the success, because we're both the universe just trying to understand each other, isn't it?
Just trying to work it out, mate.
Yeah.
Just trying to work it out. And the thing is, and this comes down to empathy as well, and it touches on your last point. There's the people, like, if you want to use Bush and his family as an example. Yeah, he's a successful guy. He's reached the top, and many would say that he's well-traveled, but he's not really. He's lived in a bubble. And a lot of people live in bubbles, whether it's a village bubble or whatever. It's not until you get out there and you expose yourself to different things and different cultures and different ways of living and thinking that you kind of develop this awareness. And in developing that awareness, and people are often baffled by the fact that Royal Marines or servicemen have got empathy, because the stereotype is that everybody thinks that you're just this mindless killer that's got no kind of intelligence whatsoever. But it's completely inaccurate. And yeah, I think the education...
That's the RAF regiment.
But education. It's education.
Don't they say you've got to witness some extreme poverty in your life to understand yourself?
Mm.
And on that subject, can we talk about Afghanistan?
Sure, mate.
How was your experience over there?
Yeah, so I mean, unbelievably, mate, I never went with a corps, and I did want to go. I kind of begged to go at the very start of it when I left training, but the drafts just didn't work out. So what I did was I applied to get into hostile close protection for about 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden I got Iraq with Olive Group and Afghanistan with a company called TOR that had a DOD contract, Department of Defense contract. And I went out there in 2013 for a year, working in Kabul. And I've operated like around Somalia, Egypt, and Iraq and stuff. But Afghanistan is the cherry on the cake in terms of hostility, and a place that just is—it's like a nightmare—is the only way to describe it. Everybody you'd feel that wants to kill you, and you know what? We saying that though, which is quite contradictory, that one of the key things that when we were working with the interpreters and people like that, because what we were doing were training the Afghan National Army how to use radios. We were protecting the engineers, training them how to use radios in classrooms, which was vastly unsuccessful because they were all asleep. But they all wanted a better life. That's one thing that they all fundamentally want, a better life. They didn't want the Taliban at all. They were all scared to death of them. And they were scared to death that the West, mainly the Americans, would leave. And all we did for that year was reassure them that it wouldn't happen. And it's happened in the worst kind of way ever. And it's just absolutely tragic. I mean, three of my mates from training, there were 11 of us that passed out at the end, and three got killed within the first, I think, 24 months of training. And I was speaking to Ben Reddy's mum just when I was going to send her a copy of the book, and she was just lost for words. Couldn't believe, clutching at straws as to the meaning of it, why it happened. But I don't know, mate. I just, for me, look, being optimistic about it, there's been 20 years of un-Taliban, in a sense, occupation in terms of power. And I'm just hoping that them two generations that have never experienced the Taliban will one day grow up and elicit positive change in the country. Long shot, but it's the only hope that I think they've got.
Yeah, you might want to look into the Belt and Road Initiative and how Americans... No, sounds really wrong saying, well, I don't mean the servicemen. I mean, that country was used to go in there and smash the place up, make a bad name for themselves, to then allow the Chinese to walk in and go, hi, guys, right, do you want to do business with us? And the Taliban are going to go, oh, yeah, you know, fine, we'll do that. And it's essentially the Belt and Road is a superhighway between Europe and China for goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of what Orwell would have called the superstates, creating superstates that are going to constantly be played off against one another. I'm only saying this not out of any disrespect for anyone that gave their all or got injured, but you know the kids that are next generation, they need to know what war is really all about.
Yeah.
And this is why I say warriors read books.
Yeah. You know what, mate? I in a sense become disillusioned with the whole thing, from being in the military to being in CP as well, private security, hostile private security. It's just not worth it.
No.
It's just none of it's worth it. And look, again, another misconception is that you go out and I get so many negative messages on my posts of people saying, oh, you're a governmental hitman. You went to work for the Queen and she don't care about you. I went for me. I wanted to go to war for me, nobody else. I wasn't fighting for the Queen. I was just fighting for me and the lads around me. It was kind of for nobody else. But once I became disillusioned with it, I just think that now, the older me, life's so precious. Just getting here and having that self-awareness that you're alive, and for that to be ripped from you, I just don't see where the worth is.
No, remember what I said. Some people are born, they can't experience love, kindness, and that's not an option for them. The only option is control. And that's what we're seeing in the world, isn't it? On a global scale, control through fear, creating all these falsities. And because they also control the education system, so they're very good at keeping people in their ego mind. Well, you know psychology. When you live out your ego, you're full of bitterness, anger, hate, fear, jealousy. You're subject to your animal desires, all what ancient Eastern scriptures would call your lower self, all the stuff that's not good that keeps you with the beasts, and all the love, the kindness, the empathy, the healthy eating, the da-da-da-da. Well, they can't have that. They can't have people that live in their upper self, because they'd have no one to go and fight these wars. So this answers your question about why in education are we not teaching, you know, we teach kids that 6 apples plus 4 apples minus 10 oranges is that stuff they're never going to use in their life. Mm. They don't teach them that from birth you're a sovereign human being under the universe. You know you're perfect as you are. You just need to go out in the world and self-actualize and be all that you deserve to be.
Mm.
But we don't see that, do we? We just see angry road rage, people trying to get ahead in their company. If someone else gets the position, it's just this constant state of fear and order out of chaos.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, it's not long between before you're knocking on the door of retirement. In a lot of respects, it happens. It just, like, my life just seems to be speeding towards that now. And you get to a point where you just want to find happiness and contentment. I look at my parents, and my old man's retired now, but my mum's still working, and she's 60 odd, and she's saying, oh, I'd love to retire. It's just, you kind of just think, well, what's the point in it all? It's just a real point of, I suppose, reflection for me at the minute. I'm just really wanting to just kind of find some meaning for where I am and where I want to be. I just want to kind of carve my own path out, really.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can work together on that, because that's, you know, I think we can support each other in this direction. I've actually coached, I think, 4 lads now through Limpston. I think all 4 of them were in Hunter Troop, so the remedial injury troop, or people that are struggling with stuff. And yeah, have a chat with your uncle Chris. I'll tweak a couple of things, mate. They've all got their green lids now, so and they all were going to leave.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible, mate. So I've got like a pre-military performance kind of training program thing that men and women come onto, young lads and women come onto. And yours is, what you've done there is quite remarkable, mate, and you need props for that, because for us, and I do all the psychology on it, trying to get people into training and through training is tough. It is tough. People have their own thoughts and their own rationale for why they ever want to continue or drop out. So getting 4 people through, mate, is a fantastic achievement.
Yeah. And also, you know, might sound a bit hypocritical, because I think people know my thoughts on the military industrial complex. But it's not really, because they're, you know, my support rubs off on them in other ways, if you know what I mean. I'm getting them to think a bit like laterally. So when you're there, you're in your military role, you can be going, what's actually really going on in this situation? And did you know Brad by any chance? Andy Bradsell, he worked for Olive. He got killed in Mosul.
No, I didn't, mate. I didn't actually do any work for Olive. I went down for the interview. I got offered the job, but I chose the role in Afghan instead.
Yeah, got you. Yeah. And that is something to live through for you alone, let alone everyone else involved. 3 people out of 11.
I've put it in the diary, mate. After Final X, they lined up the originals, of which at that point there were 11, and just said statistically, 2 or 3 of you will get killed in your first 12 months of being out of training. And unbelievably, mate, it came true. It absolutely came true. And I mean, Tom, who were kind of a Desi Oppo in training, he was the commando medalist. And what's funny about it is at the start of training, I gave him, they gave us all a KFS, a knife, spoon and sport, fork, and said, give this to a lad that visually looks like he's going to fail. And I give mine to Tom, as did a lot of other people, because he was just like a big fat teddy bear, really. Fast forward 32 weeks and he got the commando medal and I voted for him. So it was just remarkable. Such a strong...
Oh.
Sorry, mate.
Okay.
We on? Such a strong individual. And yeah, it was just, it's tough. And you know what? I think although we only spent 10 months together, and that's where our friendship was forged, he's off. I think about him more or less every day or often. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yes.
And his mum and dad have never got over it. His mum especially is just still to this day, just in a bad place.
Yeah. It's beyond belief, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, what can you say? Well, all I'll say is, is it worth it to make George Bush, Tony Blair and all the rest of the war criminals even more rich and powerful than they already are? I think that's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Mate, based on what we've seen over this last 4 weeks, it were categorically not worth it.
Well, for the psychopaths it is, believe me. Their plan is well underway. You know, they meet behind closed doors to plan all this shit.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one factor in a whole complex web of deceit. But people are waking up to it and veterans are waking up to it now, which is the best thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think recent events have done a big job of that.
Yes. Oh, definitely, definitely.
Mm.
You know, we essentially all signed up for freedom, didn't we? It wasn't really for the Queen. It was, obviously it's for an experience, but when I was in conflict, you know, I'm not being political now, but I did like to think that we were the good guys and we were on, you know, we were doing the right thing for future generations, and to see how those freedoms they've all just been, they've been stomped on a frightening rate.
We've let the Afghan people down, and I'm not just saying it because that's what everybody, that's the right thing to say on camera. I actually believe it. The Afghan people that I met were really, really superb people that don't fit the stereotype of whatever kind of refugee you want to say or whatever, or the process of othering somebody else. They were fantastic people, and we've just massively let them down. And I think had we have taken care of them, it kind of makes the sacrifice worthwhile then.
Let's finish on a more positive note, shall we? What's the future for you, mate?
Well, I'm just seeing how this goes, Chris, to be honest, mate. I've been quite, like I said, just blown away by how it's been received, men and women, and also women that are just coming forward and saying, there we go, that are saying that, look, this resonates with me when I had a bad first couple of years of motherhood with my son, just all messages like that. So it's really kind of touched a nerve across like the entire section of what you could say is society. So I'm just, I'm just really delighted, mate. I will write again. Under reflection, I started writing when I was 20 with a diary, so it's kind of not my first time, although it's my first time published. So I do want to write again. What about? I don't know, but it's been a difficult, but I've enjoyed the journey. Got a clothing range, 0.1 projects that we look at extreme kind of CrossFit and outdoor adventure and stuff like that. Still in development, still growing nicely, but we're going to kind of pull the trigger on that more so towards back end of the year. So just writing, just being creative and thinking and study. I'll definitely do some more study at some point as well. So just trying to live a good life, mate, and just be happy and find contentment.
So we'll put a link for your merchandise below the video as well?
Yeah, I certainly will, mate. I certainly will. It'd be a pleasure.
Good.
Yeah.
I should have asked you to send me a T-shirt when you sent me this wonderful book.
Mate, I'll get one out to you. I'll get one out to you.
You legend. Legend.
Yeah.
Gareth, what can I say? Really well done on the book. But equally, you know, well done on getting yourself to a good and positive place. I wish you all the best. And feel free to come back on the podcast and let us know how it's all going.
I certainly will, mate. Thank you, mate. It's been a great pleasure. And I've been waiting to kind of jump on this and have a chinwag for quite some time. So thanks for the invite, mate.
It's
greatly
pleasure.
Appreciated.
I'm going to ask you what everyone asked me. Who's going to play you in Hollywood?
Well, if it were The Voice, it'd be Morgan Freeman. And for the act, it's got to be Tom Hardy, right? He loves the Marines as well. I hear. So yeah.
Mate, remember it's Order Out of Chaos, so they'd get someone like Angelina Jolie playing you, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And to all our friends at home, massive love to you all. Thank you so much for watching another episode of the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. If you could please like and subscribe and share this video, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.